Hello?
Hello?
Yes, do I have an interpreter on the phone? A translator? Hello?
Hello?
Hello? Yes.
Yes.
Who am I speaking with now?
CO2 Helm.
Okay, you're going to be the translator for us this morning?
Yes.
Okay, would you indicate to Mr. Paul that we will be doing this by phone because we're having some technical problems, and so that we want him to be aware of the fact that this will be done by a regular telephone. So would you advise him of that, sir?
There's no open telephone market. So just the spin box left about completely in the phone for the post. And there might be some open telephone box.
Okay. He wants to read something. He wants me to read something to the Germans.
But not
the German
sure.
Embassy.
At the appropriate time, he will be given that opportunity. We just wanted him to know what was going on at this time. So, at this time, I'm going to turn the meeting over, or the hearing, rather, over to the Honorable Ms. Gail Rittenhouse, and she's going to serve as our lead to conduct the hearing this morning. And please advise Mr. Appellate that she will be the lead this morning.
Good morning. Mr. Appelt?
Good morning, ma'am. Yes.
Could you please tell me how to correctly pronounce your last name?
Yes. My name is Lee Appelt. I'm from Paul in the local council.
Appelt. Okay.
My name is Lee Appelt. I'm from Paul in the local council.
Okay, sir, could you please state your full name and your ABC number?
My name is Rudy Appelt. My name is Rudy Appelt. My name is Dr. I am moving on to 839. His number is 083093.
Thank you so much. We're appearing before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency for a 412B parole hearing, which is to a consecutive sentence or absolute discharge. Just let us know.
And okay, I'll let you know.
Yeah, we'll stop for a minute and wait till that call is done.
Okay. It's not that we're ignoring you, it's distracting when all the calls come
sure.
in.
Understood. Okay, so we were able to let him know the type of hearing, that this is 412B or absolute discharge.
412A,
he didn't exactly know what this was.
Okay.
And this is for a parole board hearing, right?
This is a parole board hearing, and the type of parole would be parole to his consecutive sentence. He's got another sentence attached beyond this one.
Okay. suggested that East Wyga put so over here the second one or just feel the first one?
We're hearing if he were paroled today, he would then start his next sentence. That's what that means.
It would affect his next sentence.
He would start on his next sentence if he were paroled today.
That's what I'm trying to get exactly what we're trying to get paroled on the first sentence or the second sentence.
Right. He would remain in prison, but he would start on his second sentence, which was conspiracy to commit first degree murder. Sentencing. The crime occurred on December 23rd, 1988, and it looked like Mr. Appelt was about 30 years old at the time. Jury on August 29th, 1990. And sentenced in November on November 6th, 1990.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you. It looks like we're unable to determine any criminal history. There really isn't any available to us, so we didn't know. Since he's been in prison, he's had one major, which is it's pretty good considering the length of time he's been there. Okay, and the most recent discipline was in 2017, though, and it was disobeying of an order, and it had to do with it was just informally resolved. It had to do with hanging bed sheets so the officers couldn't see in the cell. I think that was what that one was about.
Yeah, and I brought off the sheet and seized them on the bag.
Okay, and then before that, there was one in 2015 in December, and it was also disobeying an order, and it was a minor. So I don't know what that one was about. Okay, and this is Mr. Appelt's third hearing before this board, and the previous two times he's been denied. This is the fourth time. Oh, okay, I counted wrong then. unfortunately live here. Maybe there was another, there may have been a, oh yes, yes, there was a request for commutation. Okay, so it looks like there's some programming completed, three programs in 2014 and 2015.
He said four programs.
Four programs? Does he remember what they were? So some drug treatment or drug
rehab. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, let's see. We haven't yet, but that's kind of just background information. This crime involved a murder and a conspiracy. Obviously, the second charge is a conspiracy to commit murder. Could we ask Mr. Oppel to tell us what happened that day, the day of the crime?
He said so many years ago that he really don't understand everything what happened. He forgot so many things. It's been so many years. So he really can't say exactly what happened.
He was a shot. But why did he say he had a team for a position?
Yeah, he said the intelligence level is 55.
He said he had a shooting.
Yeah. The court himself said that he's not totally fit or intelligent enough to remember all that.
Okay. Could you please ask him if he had used drugs or alcohol at that time? So he was not under the influence at the time of the murder?
No. In deep desire, there was more of them falling. I feel as she drove it on the alcohol and she tried to argue with the bush. No, he didn't have any alcohol or drugs.
I mean, she was in.
No, he had never taken any.
Okay, thank you. What, obviously people get older and people's views change, but could you ask Mr. Oppel to just tell us what was going on in his life at the time? Just describe what was happening in his life at the time of the incident.
He didn't really do clubs and parties and stuff like that. He
Could you ask what kind of work he was doing? Who did he work for?
He did
roofing and he did a mostly construction work.
Okay, and was he, where did he live? What city?
I mean, back on the south, have you been in Düsseldorf, in my
home? In Germany or here?
Here. Where was he living at the time? Or Tucson or Florida, where did he live?
I mean,
Mesa, okay. And did he have a family? Did he have a wife, children?
He was a media, a father, and a husband, and a family in Mesa. On this, my problem is he and him and his husband.
He was married in Germany, his wife stayed in Germany while he was here.
Okay. And children? Did he have children?
She had a baby. It's not his, but she had a baby before.
Okay, yeah. So he was here in the United States by himself?
Yes. He was here with his brother, his brother's wife, and on the island.
But we don't have to tell you, each group behind us, my wife and each one of them, he had been there
the other. At that time, him and his wife was here. His brother had a girlfriend. It was like a foreigner.
Okay. And how, if he wasn't working, how was he able to get money to pay his bills?
I will do it in China, and he had a medical from the beach in the ghetto.
He saw the Russian dollars up his spot, and the Russian spot.
On the ghetto, in Deutschland, with here, Russia. He said that he worked in Germany, and he saved his money in Germany, and he came here with the money.
Okay, I see. Thank you for that. I'm going to see if my fellow board members have any questions for you. Mr. Quinones has a question for you.
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. Mr.
Quinones, don't I know you?
Is this the CO3?
CO2 Helm. I think I know you.
Interesting. Well, I have a question for Mr. Appunt.
Okay.
My question is, what brought him to Mesa, Arizona?
From Dothan, Phoenix, Arizona. He was on vacation over here.
Okay. I'll try to break this question down. First of all, I'll tell him as one voting board member, I respect his due process in this hearing.
This call has to go away.
Okay, thank you, sir.
There's another call. Yeah. You want to know what exactly?
Well,
you
just I was beginning with that. I respect his legal rights. I respect his right to an interpreter. But has he learned English at all in the last 27 years?
Chance to speak, and we'll try to do so slowly so we can allow for interpretation. You can ask questions of the board.
Yeah, but not the people.
Not the people. We're not a trial. We're not trying the case. That would be not. He can't ask directly to the people. He can talk to the board.
Okay, he understands. Just to the board, not to the people.
Exactly. Thank you. Okay, we have a number of people. Would you like to go first, or how should we? Who wants
to
go? If you come up to the microphone, we're recording. So.
My name is Catherine Hughes, and I prosecuted Mr. Hoppe.
Okay.
I would defer to the victim's advocates if they would like to go first.
Okay, whatever you think's appropriate, that would be fine. Thank you for coming. And please state your name. And again, we have to, the interpreter, so it was small bites of information.
Okay, thank you. Chairman, members of the board, good morning. My name is Jessica Gattuso. I'm an attorney with Arizona Voice for Crime Victims.
Wow, I can barely hear.
We'll have her talk right into the mic. Is the light on the mic?
It is.
Okay. Yeah, that's better.
Jessica Gattuso, and I'm an attorney.
Jessica Gattuso?
Crime victims. Gattuso.
Okay.
I represent Kathy Monkman, C. sister Cindy Monkman.
I'm just being asked on.
Her father Jack Monkman.
The slaughter of the night.
Okay, you understand you didn't know you were her?
I am here on their behalf to ask this board to deny the request to move on to the next sentence.
Okay, you understand?
Since the prosecutors are here today, I will focus mostly on the trauma to the victim as a basis for the denial. First, I'd like to focus on the trauma to Cindy Monkman herself prior to her death.
Chairman of the board, please tell him that the attorney has the legal right to present information to the board, and then the board will make its determination what part to use and make it its determination. So we will be listening to the attorney and others who will be speaking, and then he will have an opportunity to speak after everybody else has spoken.
First, I'd like to read a paragraph from a decision by the Arizona Supreme Court regarding this case on the trauma to Cindy. The evidence that the victim was struck a number of times with great force, as well as the presence of the presence of her purse in the apartment and the presence of a towel and some nylon cord at the murder scene.
Where was the place at? The apartment you said?
Cindy's purse was in the apartment. Her apartment. The towel and the nylon cord at the murder scene of the
hazard. Hello, keep going.
This indicates that she was forcibly subdued by the man she thought was her loving husband. She was conscious. And may have remained conscious during the trip to the desert.
Okay.
Scraped on her knees, suggesting that she was standing and then fell, as well as the presence of a defensive wound on one of her hands. Indicate that she was conscious as she was stabbed once in the chest, four times in the back, and as her throat was slashed.
Okay.
This is adequate to establish that she suffered great physical and emotional pain
and thus that the murder was especially cruel. This cruelty to the victim is why this inmate was originally, or part of the reason why this inmate was originally sentenced to the death sentence.
He was physically drawn, that was the fear that he found, when he was with the familiar from the trial, then saw him be his God. In fact, he was his niece, the two tried after him, which he had tried for him, so I'm not gonna do. Okay, you understand?
A judge decided that that was the appropriate penalty based on the harm to Cindy Moffin.
It's not what you have, but it's been 100% to blame next, I don't be feeling that I have money, so I'm gonna try to show, I'm sure it's a little better. Okay, the other thing.
We're only here today because of a change in law, and because of this inmate's intellectual functioning, requiring a resentencing.
Also, this gives us just knowledge when they can be there.
He cannot ask questions. Let the attorney finish her testimony, and as we stated before, he will...
No, no, Paul, I was asking the meeting, but she said something after that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was trying to clarify to him what she just said.
Okay.
Only she said something about the new law, and then after that, I didn't get it because it's hard to hear sometimes.
His death sentence had to be changed because of the new law.
Okay, that's what I was missing. They give us more, yes. I'm sure they give us more, okay, we got it.
And at that resentencing, natural life was not an option.
So, you was late on, never chosen before, so you don't want to talk to me. Okay.
Only because of the date of crime. Today, natural life would be an option for this crime.
Okay.
Now, turning to the Monkman family, including Kathy and Jack. We do have a letter written by Kathy, but before that is read, I wanted to explain a couple things to the board.
I have a brief from Kathy. It's from July. Kathy was from here last month. When he was in school, people were back in that school. Okay.
This family was not only traumatized by the loss of their family member. But also the criminal justice system.
Say again.
But also the criminal justice system.
Okay, any other
appeals, including the litigation regarding the resentencing of this inmate.
It is what I think to do to me. A case of all documents served, gives you the deserve of the deal. She does this name not get. We will not push this for you, Kurt. Okay.
The letter from Kathy Lumpen talks about frustration with the judge along the way that incorrectly interpreted a statute, and that had to be litigated.
Each club
copies for you to follow along if you wish.
Sure.
May I approach?
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're ready when you are.
My name is Kathy Monkman Hickman, and I am the sister of the victim in the case, Cindy. She was my only sister, 14 months older than me, and her life was taken on December 23rd, 1988, by Rudy A. Pelt and his brother, Michael, in the Arizona desert for one motive, money. Taken out on her in the weeks before her murder. Her body was discovered on Christmas Eve day. She was killed the day after the insurance papers arrived in the mail. I'd like to offer my opinions on this murderer, Rudy Apelt, and perhaps give you some information about him as you evaluate the options related to parole for this convicted murderer. In 2009, Rudy Apelt was deemed mentally retarded by one finder of fact, Judge Sylvia Arellano, after a lengthy death penalty appeal. He was removed from death row at that time, vacating the death sentence and replacing it with a grandfathered in life with parole sentence, which she ordered to be run consecutively to his other life with parole sentence for the conspiracy to commit murder conviction. Life without parole was not an option in Arizona when this killer was sentenced in 1990, which is why he is even being considered for parole now. Judge Arellano, in making her decision, deemed that no information related to Apelt beyond the age of 18 would be considered by her in the final outcome of that appeal. This means that the crimes for which he was convicted, first-degree murder and conspiracy to commit murder, were not considered in the determination of sentences for said crimes. Both brothers were in their late 20s at the time that they slaughtered my sister in a sophisticated scheme for $400,000 in life insurance proceeds. They had been plotting this murder for about 2 months at least. For the purposes of this hearing, I will focus on this murderer, Rudy, and the life he lived past the age of 18 and up to and including the murder of my sister, Cindy. I have seen police reports on Rudy Apelt from Germany, which include burglary, assault, insurance fraud, and rape. Rudy served 5 years in a German prison for a violent gang rape of a woman before coming to the United States and murdering my sister. Not only did he and his cohorts rape and brutalize their victim, but they left her outside the city limits for dead, much like my sister, although he made sure Cindy was actually dead before leaving her in the desert that December night. Rudy stole her car, and they drove to the airport to come to the U.S., and warrants were out for their arrest in Germany shortly after they left in the summer of 1988. It was proven in court by Rudy's own expert, famous pathologist Vincent DiMeo, that it was, in fact, Rudy himself who inflicted the majority of the stab wounds to my sister's chest, severing her aorta, piercing her lung, and then nearly decapitating her by slashing her throat. She was also severely beaten, but it was not proven who committed those blows. The knife wounds were easily established because Rudy is right-handed and his brother Michael is left-handed, and the majority of her wounds were clearly committed by a right-handed individual, according to his own expert. Michael's footprints were found on her forehead, and it was presented in court that he stood on her head as Rudy slashed Cindy's throat as she lay helpless on the desert floor. Rudy and his brother went to the nightclub restaurant Bobby McGee's and used Cindy's credit card for a celebratory dinner after they killed her. I met Rudy the very night that Cindy met the man who would kill her in a few short months. We were at a nightclub, and Rudy was supposed to be the date of one of our friends who had met this pair of brothers there the night before. But what I witnessed was Rudy blowing kisses and winking at me, which was highly inappropriate and distasteful. He was also meandering around the bar, hitting on other women and kissing them on the dance floor. Although this behavior was rude, it does not rise to the level to prove mental retardation, in my opinion. That's just common sense. He obviously possessed the savvy and bravado as well as the confidence to be able to pursue multiple women at once. I do not find this behavior evident in mentally retarded people. You might ask yourselves the same question. In the weeks leading up to murdering my sister, Rudy spent his time with his brother, lining up other women to date, asking them to marry him, pursuing them, and borrowing their cars, staying in their homes alone without his brother, lying to them while stealing money from their purses and blank checks from their homes. He was able to convince luxury car dealers, Rolex watch distributors, and custom home builder that he was anything from a professional athlete. He is tall at the time, quite stocky, to an international banker, to a pilot. Along with his brother, these stories were believed as they test drove Jaguars, BMWs, and signed a contract on a custom home, presumably pre-spending the life insurance money through his own middle sister.
And then,
as they had no other source of income other than the illegal activities and schemes. All of these people came forward to testify about their experiences with these German con artists and how they believed their lies, including consistent claims of wealth. Rudy, along with his brother, attended Cindy's funeral and got up and spoke. Eyewitnesses spoke of them driving away from the gravesite, laughing in their rental car. Their accomplice, Andre Dorn, testified that that very night they confessed to her that they had murdered Cindy. Now, with all of this information, which I have well documented in police reports and court records, if you would like me to provide supporting documentation, I encourage you to ask yourself if you would assess this violent man as a mentally retarded and give him any leniency for this or any other reason. If for some reason you give him the benefit of the doubt that Judge Arellano did, then I implore you to realize clearly that he is a danger to any society and should never be released from prison. Rudy Apelt is a sophisticated con artist and a violent man. Of this, there is no doubt, whatever label one puts on him. Please make sure he
trial in August of 1990.
I handled murder cases before these murder cases of Michael and Marie Abelt. After I concluded the trials of these two brothers, I continued to handle murder cases both as a defense attorney and as a prosecutor. As a defense attorney, I sat across men and women who had been accused of murder, and some of them actually admitted their crimes and expressed remorse. For the last 9 years of my career, which ended almost 10 years ago, I've been retired for 10 years, I was in the Homicide Bureau of the Maricopa County Attorney's Office. I went to crime scenes, well over 100 crime scenes. I never kept count. I went when the blood was still wet. I've seen numerous victims. I've seen all manner of homicides. Even though it's been almost 30 years since this crime has been committed, this crime is etched in the memory like no other. And the reason for that is because on the spectrum of first-degree murder cases, this case is on the extreme end. It's on the extreme end in the terms of the brutality of the crime. It's on the extreme end in terms of the amount of planning and premeditation. And it's on the extreme end in terms of the callous, cold, evil motive that this person, this defendant, Rudy Abelt, and his brother had. The absolute disregard for human life, which was evident in the commission of this crime, is almost beyond words. So I'd like, if you have the time and interest, to just briefly go over some of the facts. I'll try not to repeat too many of the facts that were expressed in Kathy Munkin's letter. First of all, these two men, Michael and Rudy Abelt, came to the United States from Germany in the summer of 1988. They first went to Mexico, and then they found their way to San Diego. According to the information that we received from Germany, they financed their trip to the United States by insurance fraud. They pretended that they had been burglarized in their apartment, and they received insurance proceeds. And they came to the United States, these two brothers, in the company of Rudy Apelt's wife, Susanna, and another woman, Ancador. At the time, they had about $17,000 in U.S. money. Can't remember what it was in Deutschmarks. They found their way to Arizona after the two brothers had been in a bar in San Diego without their women companions. They had met a couple of women who were visiting San Diego from the Phoenix area. And they exchanged phone numbers, and they came to Mesa, Arizona to meet up with these two women. After they came to Arizona, they were running out of money. They needed to find another source of money. And so they wined and dined a series of women, and it became immediately apparent that they were looking for a woman for one of them to marry, to insure, or to kill. This began in early September of 1988, and Cindy Munkin was murdered on December 23rd of 1988, as Kathy mentioned, just the day after the insurance policies became effective. $400,000 worth of insurance, which back in 1988 was a lot of money. In the months between the time that Cindy Munkin married Michael Apelt and the time she was murdered, Rudy Apelt pretended that he had gone back to Germany. All the while, he was hiding out in a cheap motel in Mesa with the companion Anka Dorn. He was hiding out, and when Cindy was working, Michael and Rudy and Anka Dorn would use her car, and they would go on pretend shopping sprees, spending the money that they hoped to realize with the insurance proceeds. They went, as Kathy indicated, to jewelers where they looked at Rolex watches and gave things. They went to car dealers where they test drove
initials.
They went to realtors where they looked at luxury homes. They drove around Paradise Valley and looked at luxury homes. They went to boat dealers and took their pictures and made boats. In her car, making off her money. She was working two jobs.
Please be quiet, and you will have an opportunity to speak because we're recording this, so please be quiet, Will. You will have an opportunity to speak. Excuse me for interrupting.
Michael worked as a sous chef at the Olive Garden making minimum wage. They lived off Sydney's money. Rudy lived off Sydney's money. Also, the money of another woman named Sheer Rubenstein was always able to con her out of money. The murder of Cindy Milburn was brutal. I can still see her body. She had a bloody mouth. It was cut underneath her lips where her teeth had cut her lips. Her eyes were blackened. She had, as Kathy indicated, a footprint from a Reebok tennis shoe on her forehead. And it wasn't dirt. It was a contusion because her husband, Michael, who was wearing the Reebok, had stepped on her head so hard it left a bruise. It caused a bruise. He stepped on her head to hold it steady while Rudy tried to cut off her head. Her head was hanging by a slight tendon. That's how gaping the wound was. I can see the clothes she was wearing. She was wearing a gray skirt and a white sweater. And the sweater had no hole in the front of it. But she had a hole in her chest. And you know what that told us? That told us that she was being held from behind by one of them while the other stabbed her in the chest. The sweater rode up. And she was stabbed in the chest. These men, one of them, Michael, I think, was 6'5". Rudy was 6'3" and husky. In the preparation for trial in this case, I drove out to the scene because I wanted to get a sense of what it was like for her. So a year later, I drove out. I tried to make it, you know, around Christmas time, so I wanted to get the traffic conditions and see what it was like, and it was this desolate area out near Gold Canyon Ridge. Before it was developed, it was just a desert. There was nobody there. And it was so eerie to drive out there, and I was by myself, and I thought, oh my God, what was it like for her to be out there? Not knowing even that Rudy had been in town all this time, she thought he'd gone back to Germany. She was paying for him to go back to Germany. And all of a sudden, she's confronted with these two huge men, one of whom she thought loved her. And she's beaten and stabbed and nearly decapitated. And all in all, I can think of what she must have been thinking as she was laying there dying to be found the next morning. The day before Christmas, by a young boy on an ATV who was about 12 years old. Me and Michael Apel spent the next 2 weeks covering their tracks, trying to make it look like this was a drug deal gone awry. They flew back for the funeral, and Michael pretended to be grief-stricken, and Rudy took over, he played this game, he got up, and he pretended, oh, you have to forgive my brother, he was just so overcome with grief. Let him take over for him. They have a person there who can interpret in German. Kathy's right. They celebrated afterwards. We had that information from Honda Door. After that, they flew to Los Angeles and picked up a homeless person off the street, paying $20 to read a threatening message back into Cindy's phone answering machine. Hear what I have to talk. Frequently stabbed her in the front and in the back with a knife. A direct translation from German. There's any question this woman is guilty. As Captain indicated, when Rudy A. Peltman on trial, her brother had already been convicted. And so his defense was, Michael Bennett, I never had anything to do with it. And he called the renowned pathologist Vincent DeMaio to testify that it was a single assailant. Dr. DeMaio reenacted the murder, and it became apparent that Dr. DeMaio's opinion it was a right-handed person that inflicted these awful wounds. Rudy, of the two brothers, was the one who was right-handed. He's the one who inflicted these wounds. He deserves no mercy. The motive was greed. The brutality is off the scale. And the premeditation and planning that went into this is as long as any case I've ever seen in all of my experience. Months I planned this. During the course of our investigation, I traveled to Dusseldorf, and we didn't get a lot of cooperation from the German government, no official cooperation, because they were legal death penalty, and so they wouldn't give us any certified records. But we got a lot of cooperation from the homicide detectives in Dusseldorf. And I sat up in the conference room of the Dusseldorf Police Department with these homicide detectives, with a detective I brought with me from Mesa, who spoke German, and they read to us the records of Rudy A. Peltman. We already knew from Interpol that they had criminal records. But they read, I don't read German, so I can't attest that I actually saw the German police reports, but the German detective from the company did. And Rudy A. Peltman was convicted of rape. He served a prison sentence in Germany, according to what I learned during that trip. And one of the things I remember vividly from having read those reports was that there was a towel and some cord at the crime scene of the rape. There was a towel and some cord at this crime scene. During the time that these two defendants were premeditating this murder, they went out into the desert and they practiced the crossbow. These are tips for this crossbow. The kind of tips are used for hunting, to kill something. They bought this crossbow, and they weren't very good at it, so on the door of this, they abandoned the idea of killing her with the crossbow. And while I was in Germany, I learned that they had a celebrated, infamous, I guess would be the better word, murder case involving a German man who had killed his wife with a crossbow. Kathy Morgan mentioned that Judge Arellano had reduced Rudy Appelt's sentencing because of his IQ, basically. And I don't know how familiar you are with that proceeding. I was somewhat involved in that proceeding. And if you aren't that familiar with it, then maybe parts of Kathy's letter were a little confusing, but there are two prongs, basically, in determining whether or not a person is eligible for the death penalty if they have a low IQ. One of them is the actual numerical IQ, and the other is adaptive functioning. whether they've been able, notwithstanding the low IQ, to function in society. And I think what Kathy was trying to get at was that Judge Arellano didn't take into account the adult functioning past the age of 18. And what we had tried to present at that time was that there was all kinds of evidence of his adaptive functioning. During the course of the premeditation of this crime, it was obvious that he got along quite well, notwithstanding that he had a relatively low IQ. So there's one final thing that I'd like to address, and that is that I've been privileged to maintain a relationship with these victims, the survivors, for 30 years. And so I've had sort of a close view of, I don't see them all the time, you know, we're not great friends, but we're friends. I probably see them two or three times a year. And no matter who you are, if you haven't experienced this murder yourself, you only get a glimpse into how dreadful it is. But from what I've observed, this is a resourceful, resilient family. And I think for them, I mean, as crushed as they were at the time, I remember Kathy's description of what it was like when they were, she was back in Illinois when they notified them Christmas Day that Cindy's body had been found. What it was like, she wrote it down to for catharsis, I guess. You know, how they reacted when the police called on Christmas Day that she was dead. But what I observed is that with families, with most victims, it never goes away. It's not like it's always there. It's like a low-grade infection. You know, you always have the impact of this murder. And then every once in a while, something just triggers it. And it just brings it all up. And I observed that in Jack, my father, about 10 years after the murder was Wendelin. And he and his wife had been downsizing, and they came across a little memento of Cindy's, and he wanted to show it to me. And 10 years later, he's crying because he's showing it to me. And just last year, I had occasion to be living everything, and you could just see the infection in full bloom again. And I think that's what it must be like every time she has to hear it come before this board for another parole hearing. The bottom line is that, in my view, this crime is off the charts. And he has gotten, this person has gotten all the mercy he should ever be shown when Judge Arellano reduced his sentence from death to life. And there isn't any doubt in my mind that if she could have given natural life, she would have. And in fact, when she was resentencing him, his lawyers asked her to run his second sentence concurrent, and she refused. She said, this case deserves consecutive sentences. So I would implore this board to deny him parole at his first sentence. You know, if you have any questions about any of the facts, I'd be happy to respond.
Just one, and again, this is more of a clarification, because when you told quite a summary, he was seen by the court as having a low IQ?
Yes, it was determined in 2009. Between the time he was sentenced in 1990 and 2009, the United States Supreme Court determined that if a person was mentally deficient, that they were eligible for the death penalty, and that there were two prongs that a court should consider. One was the actual IQ, and the other prong would be adaptive function. How well does the person get along? Are they able to function in society, notwithstanding the low IQ? And Judge Arellano just determined that there was evidence from Germany that he had a lower IQ. And so she made the determination that he was ineligible for the death penalty, so she reduced it. And where what Kathy Munger was getting at in her letter was, I think what she was getting at is that, and my memory of this is not really that sharp, but that she had made a determination that she couldn't consider how well he was functioning at the time of the crime. She could only consider how well he functioned before the age of 18. And so, because of that, she determined that he was ineligible for the death penalty.
So, again, we're not here to try the case, but there were no new IQ tests. It was any information that was gathered prior to the age of 18.
He and his brother both made the same claim, and they both did take new IQ tests, and the new IQ tests, I'm really having a hard time remembering the scores. I think they were higher on the ones that he took in the United States when he was in 2009, however old he was then, were higher, but still lower threshold.
Thank you.
And I can't remember the threshold.
No, I just want to understand that, but thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate your testimony.
Sorry, I have allergies in addition to any of the
right. Understood completely. Does anyone else wish to speak on this? Okay, thank you so much. Okay, back to you, Mr. Oppelt.
Yes.
We're coming toward the end of your hearing, and I want to give Mr. Oppelt the opportunity to make a final statement, if he would like to do that. He could read his... did he have a letter he wanted to read? Or?
Yeah.
Okay, so, the time.
Sure. You've got two questions. Do you get a letter from the town? You said I'm going to call him. Do you get a letter from the town? Is it an alcohol limit?
He wanted to know that everything that was said, if you have it on recording.
Yes.
Recording. Okay. He has a letter from the German council from California, and it's stating that I really felt, 83093. Have to receive a qualified translator from German to English and English to German with no issue of translation. That the translator is fully aware of all legal consequences of this request and of the state of Arizona dealing with international prisoners and with the U.S. federal international law. The translator must state for record that he or she is a qualified translator or not. And if so, how are they qualified? He's pretty much saying that he wants a licensed translator.
Because
his IQ is 55, he needs a licensed translator. I know the DOC, none of us are licensed, but that's what his letter said.
Okay.
Well, first of all, CO3N, Mr. Pell, we don't have a copy of that letter to the best of my knowledge. We would have to have a copy of that letter, and then we would pass it by our legal counsel. We're not going to comment on that today.
Okay, he has one other question.
My copy is less feet. Is that from Germany?
Okay, he didn't know that they had been told 2 days before.
He just told him what 2 days before. Excuse me.
Please.
But what did they tell him 2 days before?
The Deutsche
They only told him a couple of days ago that he was coming here today?
Yeah, he signed back on, May 22nd. Now, that's more than 2 days ago. That's almost a month.
He
signed back on it on May 22nd, but they didn't exactly tell us what day he was coming up with for the board. They didn't give me any paper work on what time or when they were going to show.
Well, he signed in 403. He should have been presented, and I'm not being critical one way or the other. He should have been presented a copy of what he had signed. And he did sign this, as my distinguished colleague has indicated, back on May 22nd, and it says in plain English, and hopefully somebody would have translated this into German, "I wish to appear before the Arizona Board of Executive Clemency at the board hearing scheduled for June 21st, 2018. And that is today's date. I don't know whether... But he did sign it, and as you know, legally, when you sign something, you're supposed to know what you're signing. I can't testify to that because we were not there, but he did sign it, and we do have a copy of that being signed by him.
He said he only got it in English, he did not get it in German, he did not understand exactly everything that
to provide a translator, and that's where we are at this particular time. We followed our protocol at this time, and that's all I'm going to say. We followed our protocol.
Yeah, that's my...
assistance to our ministry of giving whenever we receive the offer.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, the problem is coming in is that everything that's said here, he can't understand it because everything was just read off.
Let me just ask one other question. I said I'm not going to ask another question. This is his, to my knowledge, and to my being involved, this is his third time coming before this board. To the best of my knowledge, he did not make those requests in the past. In fact, at one of them, I actually chaired myself, and he did not make that request at that time. So now he's coming to add something new at this particular time, and we are not in a position to deal with that at this time. He knows himself that this is his third time recently appearing before this board, and he knows what he said at that time, and he knows that I chaired the first one, recent one that he had. I chaired it back on, according to Ames, I chaired that one on May 25, 2017. The Honorable Mr. Johnson chaired it, and I don't recall any of this information being requested. And if he wants to make these requests, then he has the right to make these requests. But we need to move on at this time for him to make his final statement as has been requested by the lead person for this hearing.
He wants to just say one thing, make a statement on it, that last time I acted as a translator for him, and we asked for the translator last time on it. When he was the one, we were on the screen last time when he requested that. And he just wanted to make it clear that he's requesting that again. That's all I'm doing, just letting you know about his request.
And that's all you're supposed to do, sir. But please let him know that we carry out our responsibility, and that is to have a translator, and that is you, sir. Now, whether he's talking about, you know, someone who's certified and all of that, now that's something different, but our protocol here is that the institution, Lewis in this case, will provide a translator, and Lewis has provided that translator, and if he has problems, then he can get back to someone with that. And probably remind him, I don't know what he meant, but he also indicated when the Honorable Mr. Corrales asked the question earlier that he can understand English. Thank you.
He's just saying that the only problem is that, you know, he didn't get enough time with a notification, even though he signed it on May 22nd, that he would have tried to set up with the German people, whoever, for a licensed translator. And everything that the lawyers read and everything, he needed that in German, everything to be able to, because he has an IQ of 55, that he must be able to know 100% of what is happening. And when they read these letters and stuff, or the court cases from 1988 or 1990 and stuff, and all the events, none of that I'm able to translate to him. Why? Because I'm not even allowed to speak during reading the letters.
Yes, you were allowed to speak. In fact, my recollection is that he asked that we would, that they would just go ahead and read the letter. He did not ask us to allow you to translate.
Yeah, and that's what he said, you know, just go ahead and read it and stuff.
But I think it would be most appropriate now for him to make his final statement as been requested by the chair of this hearing, by the lead person of this hearing, so he can make his final statement at this time.
Okay, we'd like to thank you on everyone there for giving him the opportunity to come before you on the board.
One people time, ich bin wirklich unschuldig, ich weiß, die sprechen gegen mich, weil ich Deutscher bin und er ist nicht kranker Mann bin.
Okay, he, I'd like to thank you, Tom, but he put emphasis that he's not guilty of any crime, that the statement that people said he was guilty of, and...
Ich bin kein Kopf, dass wir die gegen die, weil ich gut bin, ich kann nicht verstehen, die gegen die Gefahr.
Okay, because of his IQ level, that he really can't understand everything, why he's in here, or what he's guilty of. He knows that they're convicting him of something, but because of his IQ level and stuff, he doesn't understand everything. He never did anything wrong.
He was just a friend of his son.
He doesn't want anybody angry at him or mad at him for no reason at all, but he put in with it that he had nothing to do with it.
We tried to keep it for shame.
And he hopes that everyone understands, family members and everybody understand that he's not guilty of anything. He committed no crime.
Thank you.
And he thanks you, all the men and the women on the board, everybody on the board.
That's especially with the Atlantic Farm Deutsch.
And
that's especially with the Atlantic Farm.
And that he wants everyone to know in his own words in German that he likes to thank everyone. He'll forgive my opportunity.
No.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. So the board is going to go into discussion. And while the board is in discussion, if you just tell Mr. Oppelt, he just needs to remain silent. He can listen to the discussion, and then we will be back with him with a decision.
Okay. Thank you for everything.
All right, thank you, sir. The board is now in discussion. This has been a very detailed hearing. We heard a lot of details about the crime itself and about Mr. Oppelt's background. We heard from him that he still maintains his innocence in this crime.
He's going to see what somebody interpret since he's saying that he's...
Okay.
Would you interpret what the Honorable Mr. Rittenhouse is saying so that he will not say that he did not know what was being said, sir?
He's just saying that
not
because of the IQ level that...
We just want you to interpret for him what Mr. Rittenhouse is saying, the Honorable Mr. Rittenhouse is saying at this time, so he will understand what the board is saying to him at this time.
Okay.
We're not asking him to comment, but it's asking him to listen, but he needs to know what he's listening to, what we're saying on our end.
So this cannot be even what he's going to stop. On the Gothic side, I was married in the house that we have in the situation. When there are a lot of us in South Korea, in South Korea, and I, the father, I was like, okay,
thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, we were able to be provided details about the crime itself from the person who prosecuted the crime.
Question on the
understand the crime, or did he understand what the board did?
He don't need to understand anything. He just needs to understand what...
No, I'm trying to understand exactly what you want me to tell him.
Exactly word for word in German what Ms. Rittenhouse is saying. That's all we want you to tell him at this time.
Mr. Oppelt's discipline record in prison. To see if people have, if the individual has changed or grown as a person. Itself, Mr. Oppelt's behavior in prison and programming and what he's told us today, I am not in favor of granting parole to a consecutive sentence. Just one board member, so I would open it up for discussion to other board members at this time.
Okay.
Any discussion from other, Mr. Quinones?
Thank you, Ms. Rittenhouse. This is board member Louis Quinones. I agree with you, and I just wanted to add that Mr. Appelt makes very intelligent commentary for an individual with such an allegedly low IQ. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Quinones. Other comments from board members?
Madam,
Dr.
Was that all? That for all of you today?
Yes, sir. Yes, this is C.Q. Wright, chairman of the board. This is my third time hearing Mr. Bell in 16, 17, and now 18, and I was listening to hear something different that would persuade me to change my vote from the other two times.
And
as of this moment, I have not heard anything to change my mind from the folks. Therefore, I am not in favor of paroling him to his next consecutive sentence or absolute discharge.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, sir. I'm going to make a motion then, and this is based on everything we've heard today. I am going to move to deny parole 412D to the consecutive sentence and absolute discharge for Mr. Oppo, and further I request a 1-year set off.
Second.
I'm sorry, who seconded? Mr. Quinones? Okay, Mr. Quinones seconded. Dr. Wright agrees, and Mr. Neal agrees. Okay. Reasons for denial. CO2?
Yes.
If you could make note of these and translate these are the reasons for denial. Serious and violent offense. There's quite a list. If you want to translate them one at a time, that's fine.
Okay. What?
Serious and violent offense. Loss of human life. Serious and deviant offense. Trauma to the victim. Serious bodily injury. Victim harassment, and I say that specifically because of the detailed testimony we received today with regard to how she was treated. History of assaultive behavior, prior criminal history, recent disciplinary infractions from 2017, and no family community support system. Can any board member think of anything else that they would add to that? Okay, Mr. CO2, that's our complete list. He's been denied, and he will come before this board again in approximately a year. The Department of Corrections will certify him. Okay, thank you, sir. And CO2, what is your name again? I'm sorry.
My name is Helen.
Okay.
H-E-L-M. That's number 4-5.
We want to thank you very much because this is very difficult to do. And
It is. And I do know Keon, that thing. You're going to talk to the school district.
Okay. I know we're still on records there, but I'm from that family.
Okay, now I believe we have another hearing. Do you have someone else there for us, sir?
Yeah.